We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board while Willard's getting booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom. Dave Woodard, here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Lots going on, as always. It's Earth Day today. Did you know that? Get out and roll around the grass. Get some grass stains on you. Get some dirt under your fingernails. Do something. Just throw a dirt bomb. Whatever. Remember those as a kid? No? Why don't you explain them to us? No. Let's move on. Anyway, it's Earth Day. Today is Earth Day. And I was thinking about this. And I started to laugh, and I thought, and I don't mean to be cynical here. I'm going to, too late, Dad. Because like the majority of Canadians, and there's lots of polling to support this, the majority of Canadians are concerned about climate change. The majority of Canadians want to do the right thing. The majority of Canadians, want to be conscious of the climate moving forward and do our best to, reduce our footprint and emissions and all of that stuff. But as we sit here today and celebrate Earth Day, I'll start with how I was going to end this. Does Earth Day still have the same impact? And I'm not suggesting that issues regarding the environment and the Earth don't have impact. No, I would say they have greater impact. But does the day, Earth Day, it's Earth Day. So people go out and gather some garbage. Other people, you know, there's an announcement of a battery plant that Honda's going to expand. Do you think that just happens to be a coincidence? Today's Earth Day, that's kind of leaking out. No, it's all part of the game. And I get it. And I understand it. And like I said, most Canadians support the notion that we have to protect our climate and our planet. But we just don't necessarily agree with Justin Trudeau. So, of course, in his fantasy world, that makes you a climate change denier, which is the farthest thing from the truth. We just don't agree that everybody should be taxed for it. And clearly, the majority of Canadians feel that way, which is why the government is tanking in the polls and people are screaming and yelling. So I would suggest that every day in Canada is Earth Day. And I would suggest every day in Canada is Earth Day because we pay for it every day through a carbon tax, which now they're not calling. Remember at the beginning, it's a carbon tax because tax is bad and we're going to tax away that carbon. Now it's a rebate. It's gone from carbon tax, carbon's bad, bad, bad carbon, tax, tax, tax. It's gone from that to a rebate. You know, we need a harp and some flowers to be presented at this point. So, and again, you can change the branding all you want. It's still the same. It's a consumer tax and it's on the backs of Canadians and it affects everything that you purchase. That's just the truth. And I don't need to tell you that because you're feeling it just like every other Canadian is. So I would suggest that every day is Earth Day for Canadians. And perhaps a chance to step back and pause and ask if the environmental movement is really doing the best for the planet, the best for the country, the best for you. Because in my view, the extreme environmentalist movement has failed and failed terribly because they're inflicting pain, yet nothing really seems to be getting better. And we've talked over and over and over again about Canadian liquid natural gas, which everybody wants. But for some reason, the Justin Trudeaus of the world don't think there's a business case. Yet Dofasco found one because all the environmentalists came down here when they heard that the Dofasco was going electric. But yeah, that's after 20 years of natural gas, just like our energy system in Ontario, just like the energy system in Alberta is transitioning away from coal to natural gas. So I would suggest we have failed, or the extreme environmentalists have failed, in harnessing this energy, in harnessing this attitude for change and to move forward, and just saying, shut off the taps. And I had this discussion with Elizabeth May, head of the Green Party, just within the year, Why don't we focus on getting the world off of gas? I hear that will eliminate 10, 20, 30, 40% of the world's emissions. Why don't we do that? And just without even batting an eye, she said, too late for that. But she said that to me 20 years ago when I asked her the exact same question. And think of where we'd be 20 years ago, or where we'd be now, if we had made a conscious movement to get the rest of the world off of coal and help them do that. Or supply greener forms of energy, like liquid natural gas, to countries who are buying it from dirty players. So I'm not sure we should be celebrating Earth Day the same way that we have in the past. I think we should be looking inward and asking, is Earth Day really doing it for us? Are the environmentalists really doing it for us? Are they really getting the job done? Or are they just pissing everybody off and creating a divisive world and not really looking for solutions if it has anything to do with an alternative? Let's just put all the eggs in one basket, please. And so in that respect, I think the environmental movement has failed, and we should take this Earth Day not to pick up a garbage bag and clean up the litter, although go ahead, because we do it anyway, whether it's Earth Day or not, and we pay for it every day, whether it's Earth Day or not. But we should honestly ask ourselves if our environmental policies are actually working, or as the Prime Minister would say, fair for everyone. Because I'm not sure Earth Day is the success that it once was. Perhaps in other parts of the world, but certainly not in Canada. The federal budget came out on the 16th, although it really came out in the 3 weeks prior to that, as the Prime Minister and the government is on pretty much like a communications public relations campaign, saying that the problem that they have is you don't understand what's going on, and they haven't done a good enough job of explaining it to you and how you should feel about it, considering you're living it, of course. So now that we've had some time to digest the federal budget, many are asking how it affects small business and independent businesses. And the reason being is the Bank of Canada has said just very recently, using the phrase in case of emergency, break the glass, and now's the time to break the glass, that innovation is down, investment is down. It's just not where it should be. We're not generating revenue to be giving stuff away. And again, with this latest budget, what does it do for those small and independent businesses that provide so many jobs? Dan Kelly with us, president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. And with us now, Dan, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm good, doing well, but lots of fights ahead.
But I understand you got the a bit of a break on the carbon tax. So why isn't everybody just happy with that, Dan, and moving on?
Look, it is good news that the government finally, 5 years later, has said that they're going to release the money that they set aside to give to small businesses. Consumers have been receiving rebates from the very beginning, since 2019. Businesses will start to receive their rebate back from 2019 sometime later in 2024 or perhaps early 2025. But it is good news that the government has landed on a methodology to return the $2.5 billion back to small businesses across Canada. Of course, along with that, there were some major changes to capital gains that are freaking out a lot of business owners.
So obviously, the carbon tax check isn't the issue here. How is small and independent business viewing this budget?
Yeah, with some trepidation. Look, the fact is that there were a ton of capital gains changes, kind of four big changes made to the way that capital gains taxes affect small businesses. And businesses have only really heard about one, and that's the increase from 50% inclusion to two-thirds inclusion. That piece, of course, is bad news, but there are a couple of wins. The lifetime capital gains exemption, if you sell your business after your business company, the shares of your business, after a lifetime of hard work, right now, the first $1 million you upon sale is exempt from capital gains altogether at 0%. That's now going to be an even larger portion that will be exempt from taxation. Instead of $1 million, it'll be $1.25 million. So that's a win. Secondly, the government has said that they're going to introduce a new Canadian Entrepreneurs Incentive. So the next $2 million in upon sale of your business will be taxed ultimately at 1/3 rather than 50%. So that's good news too. Anything above that will be taxed at the 67% rate. And if you have businesses that have other investments within the corporation, that will also, those capital gains treatment for those will get worse as well. That'll go to 2/3. So there are a lot of businesses that will be winners from this, and there will be a lot that unfortunately are losers as a result of these tax changes. I've got both within my membership, unfortunately.
So it's like you take six from another, and a half a dozen from another. And I mean, how does this wash down, Dan? So is this worth it? Is it good? Is it bad? Or is it a distraction budget? No, it's over here. No, it's over there.
You know, the government is using this clearly as a political wedge to try to tax the so-called rich.
Yeah.
I'd describe this more accurately, though, as tax the middle. Businesses, they are exempting them from most of the punishment for very small businesses. But medium-sized businesses are going to get hit with higher capital gains. And if you want to grow your small business from small to medium-sized, hire a few more people, put on another plant, you're going to end up facing much higher tax treatment as well. So, we have a problem right now. In Canada, for the first time really in recorded history, we have had month after month of more businesses closing than businesses opening. Typically, at any other point, even in recessions, there are more businesses opening their doors rather than closing their doors. That's not the case right now. It's deep. It should worry us all. And some of these changes are going to send the message to businesses that once you get to a certain size, it's not really worth growing your business any further. I don't think that's the message we want entrepreneurs to be hearing.
I heard just last week when this came out, this isn't creating growth. This isn't creating wealth. This is redistributing wealth. So, Bank of Canada says we need innovation, we need investment, we need entrepreneurship, we need all of this. Does this answer that? Does this, or in your mind, does it hinder it?
Look, I think if you want to grow your business from small to slightly less small, there are some incentives in place. It actually does improve the ground for a few. But the larger message is that if you want to try to grow your business, you're going to be hit with much, much higher taxes. And that's not the message. So no, I don't think there is a growth message in this at all. I think what this is another income redistribution from those that have, that are trying to grow their businesses to the rest of us. And I'm not sure that that's the message that, again, we want entrepreneurs to be hearing, is that if you get your business going and it's doing pretty well, then maybe that growth or expansion or second location should be somewhere else outside of Canada. That's sure a bad message to send to the businesses on whom we rely for job creation and to pay a huge chunk of the taxes that all of us benefit from.
We had a senior economist from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives on before the weekend and said that this is all blown out of proportion. It's all an exaggeration. It's not going to make that big of a difference. It's just, making those people who make more pay a little bit more. Obviously, you don't agree.
Well, look, it's true. It will make more. Some of those people that make more will pay a little bit more. But if we depend on those people who make more to actually create jobs for us, create economic wealth, then, what are we doing? I do worry about doctors. Doctors are squarely in the eyes of this. They don't qualify for some of the preferential treatment. We could all say, well, the doctors can afford it. But if that doctor says I get a better deal by moving my practice elsewhere, to another country, that's going to make the doctor shortage worse. If a construction company says, it's going to make more sense for me to locate any growth outside of Canada, that's going to make the housing shortage worse. So I don't know. It doesn't seem we've got to make sure that we think these things through and not just react based on sloganeering as we approach an election.
Dan Kelly, president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, fallout of last week's budget. Dan, thanks for the time. Good luck.
Anytime.
As the federal government touts measures to curb the cost of Canadians, all affordability, I guess, but including cell phone bills, some say there's a disconnect between what consumers are paying and the rhetoric surrounding the price declines. This stems from a piece, I guess this was on X, from the Prime Minister's social media account there, saying the cost of cell phone plans since 2019 have dropped, are half of what they used to be. Are we paying half of what we did before? Let's bring in Carmi Levy, technology analyst and journalist, in here now. Carmi, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Hi, Scott. Boy, do I wish I were paying half what I used to pay. And I asked around some of my friends, and they shrugged their shoulders as well. They said, if anything, they're paying more than they were a few years back. They're not quite sure where the Prime Minister's tweet comes from.
I think we would have noticed that, would we have not, if all of a sudden, boom?
Yeah, I think so. I think if your cell phone bill were cut in half over any period of time, that would certainly get your attention. But in fact, all I hear, and you know, I'm kind of the go-to in my friends group for whenever there's a technology question, they always come to me for reasons I don't quite understand.
And yeah, so, I don't know. How are we surprised? I'm calling you for that reason, Carmi. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And I'm always happy to hear from you, as you know. But and the biggest complaint that I get is often around costs of services, particularly phones. Services, wireless services, telecom. And that hasn't changed any. No one has ever called me and said, gee, Carmi, I'm paying less than I used to. So yeah. You know, I think what's happening here is that it isn't really so much about the total amount. And so I think it's somewhat disingenuous for the PM to say cost of cell phone plans have been cut in half over the last 5 years. That isn't the case. What we are, in other words, we're paying more than we are, because the data from, that we're seeing from Statistics Canada shows that ARPU, or average revenue per user, that's a much more critical metric, is actually going up in the industry. So we may be paying less than half according to the PM, but we are still at the average customer of a telecommunications company is still sending more money every month to these companies. So what the PM is referring to isn't so much the total cost. I think he misspoke. He's speaking about value. And so I looked at my bills, and five years ago, my plan was a 4 gigabyte per month plan for a certain amount of dollars. And here I am 5 years later, and I'm a couple phones in. I've replaced my devices a couple times. I've, sort of called them up to see what they can do. I'm paying about $15 a month more, and that seems to be right around where most of my contemporaries are paying, but I'm getting a lot more data. I'm getting 20 gigabytes per month, five times as much data. And what's different about the data now is back in 2019, when I hit that 4 gigabyte limit, anything over that, I went over. So I tracked my data pretty carefully. Today, if I hit 20 gigs or I go over whatever limit is on my contract, I'm not going to pay anymore. So the data is going to slow down significantly. So if I really want to, play games, which I don't do, but in case I did, I would notice my connection slowing down, but I won't be charged an overage charge. So technically I'm getting better value now, but it's still costing me more per month. And so I think the Prime Minister, he's right that things are better than they were to a certain extent, better value, but we're certainly not getting a bargain.
But that's the advancement of technology that's enabling that. And they're just not hitting you for that. That's like saying, well, a car is more expensive now, but geez, look what a car can do now compared to what it used to do 50 years ago. I mean,
exactly. You're absolutely right. And we can't sort of look at it. So I'm getting technically five times as much data for a similar price, a little bit more than I was 5 years ago. And so someone would look at me and go, well, then you're getting, five times as much value. And my answer to that is no, I'm not. Because the wireless internet of 2024 is a very different place than the wireless internet of 2019 was. So a gigabyte today is not a gigabyte from 5 years ago. It doesn't go as far. The apps that are on my phone are much larger. The operating system is bigger. Just to sort of keep the phone alive, it moves a lot more data back and forth. And so you can't do an apples to apples comparison from 5 years ago to today. A gigabyte just doesn't go as far as it used to.
And again, their costs would have gone down in that respect as well. So
yeah,
that's technology advancing.
That's right. And in the last 5 years, they've also, the big change in the industry has been the transition from fourth generation or 4G wireless to 5G wireless. And so every time I bring that up, when I call my provider, the answer I get back is, well, you're on 5G now, so it's even better. It's worth more to you. That's why we can charge a premium. So they keep finding new ways. 5G, there's a premium. Bundling with all these other services, maybe your TV, maybe your home internet, maybe some other services, home security, there's another value add. There are all these additional charges that, yeah, maybe you're paying less for data, but you add up the total size of the pie, not just this one little slice, and you're still forking over more per month, whether you like it or not. And if you try to cut that monthly bill, and as I've certainly tried Lord knows how many times, there really is no convenient way to do it. And when you cross the street to another carrier, guess what? The language you hear from them is exactly the same thing. They are all following the same playbook.
So one of the reasons we're paying so much for houses right now is because we have indoor toilets. Like, look how far we've come. My goodness. All right. I can't let you go, Carmi, without asking about the whole TikTok controversy. The House has passed legislation in the U.S. that would ban TikTok in the U.S., if they don't, the China-based social media giant doesn't sell its stake within a year. This is sort of grouped in with a larger bill as part of the Ukraine package. So if it doesn't go through, then the whole thing comes back. So what are your thoughts on this? Does it look like they're going to go through with this in the U.S.?
It's just as murky now as it was before this law was passed. Of course, it still has to go through a bunch of different checkpoints in the legislative process before it becomes law. But what's interesting is that along the way, the timeline changed. Originally, it was proposed as we will give TikTok 6 months to sell its American operations, or it will be subject to a national ban. That 6 months has now become 12 months. So while I'd like to say we've gotten closer to a possible go dark date, the reality is that the timeline is even further now. Now there's a year now. And what's interesting is ByteDance, which owns TikTok, has essentially said, we are going to gather the wagons around. We're going to fight this tooth and nail. So the company is being increasingly belligerent about not taking this sitting down as the law continues to move forward. So the sabers are rattling ever harder, and the war chants are getting louder from both sides. But it's still very unclear as to whether this will play out. And quite frankly, even if the law ultimately is passed, the logistics of the U.S. government forcing a global company like ByteDance to shut down an app that's used by 170 million people within the borders of the U.S. It's never been done in the U.S. on that scale before. And quite frankly, I don't think anybody wants it to get to that point.
And the U.K. thinking about the same thing.
Yeah, although what I find interesting is the UK didn't move forward with its plans until the US sort of had some momentum with its legislative agenda. So it'll be interesting to see if the UK following the American lead, is that a one-time thing? Or is this the beginning of a global trend of companies, of countries that are looking at what's happening in the US and saying, we really don't like, you know, China using its app economy to leverage us geopolitically. Maybe we're going to jump on that bandwagon too. It could go either way, but the UK joining in is really interesting. I'm watching the European Union to see if they do that. I'm watching a whole bunch of other countries. Canada, you're on notice as well.
We're out of time. Okay, we'll continue this later. Carmi Levy with us, technology analyst and journalist, talking about cell phone bills, everything from cell phone bills to TikTok, all in one segment. Carmi, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Appreciate it, Scott. Thanks.
The head of Israeli military intelligence said Monday he would resign because of Hamas's October 7th attack, becoming the first senior figure to step down over his role in the stunning failure to anticipate or quickly respond to the deadliest assault in Israel's history. To talk more about all of this, Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History, Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto as well. Jack with us now. Jack, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Hope you are too.
Why now? What's happening here? Why is this happening now?
Well, part of why it's happening now is that we are in a bit of a lull in military operations. The showdown with Iran seems to have been concluded. The ground offensive against Rafah has yet to take place. And at a relatively quiet time, I suppose you've really got the optimal moment, although it's never really that great, to dispense with the military guy who's been identified as the scapegoat. And that's basically what's happened to General Halavi. We have to understand that while Israel has a multitude of political parties and political divisions, respect for the military is very strong there. It's one of the most respected unifying institutions in the nation. People are keenly conscious of the fact that they rely upon it daily for their security. And October 7th really shook their confidence in the military. And to some extent, fairly or not, General Halabi is carrying the can for that.
This is a pretty significant miss for all the reasons you just said. Can leadership stand back and watch this person fall on the sword here? How did this get past a top leadership?
Well, we have to understand the actual chain of command. The intelligence directorate had good indications that an attack was imminent. They didn't pass it on to the military leadership or the political leadership. So that was a failure at that level. But ultimately, this happened on the prime minister's watch. And that's one of the reasons that his popularity has declined radically since October the 7th. There are people within his coalition government who've publicly said that he should step down, but somebody's got to be the scapegoat. It looks as if it's going to be General Halabi, at least for now. But I would not be at all surprised if other departures followed.
How much is this failure to not see this coming, anticipate the significance of this, or just the size of it? How significant is it, or is it related to rather the failure that we've seen to catch this now as a result of the very aggressive attacks that we're seeing now? Is one meant to cover up the other? In other words, we goofed here, so we're going to make sure we finish it here.
Well, intelligence failures on this scale. And this, I would argue, is the greatest intelligence failure since the American failure to anticipate Pearl Harbor, are unusual. But intelligence is never clear-cut. It's always somewhat ambiguous. It's rarely conclusive. And you have to interpret it through whatever the prevailing political assumptions are about what your enemy's goals are, what he's likely to do. Now, there were strong indications from as early as May of 2022 that something was up in Gaza. There were reports from the time and from people fairly close to the ground, where Israel maintains extensive audiovisual surveillance of Gaza, monitors telecommunications. There was ample evidence that preparations for something were going on. High-level Hamas people were there, apparently engaged in what looked like rehearsals for invasions, for kidnappings. Some of the likely targets on the ground were actually identified. But the assumption was that Hamas was relatively satisfied at the moment, that because the government has pursued for some years a policy of playing Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority and the West Bank off against each other, and this had entailed something of a tilt toward Hamas recently, that Hamas was unlikely to do anything terribly radical, and that these preparations were just related to drills, to exercises, not to an impending attack. And in fact, a few hours before the attack took place, Israeli monitoring of telecommunications revealed large-scale activation of cell phones in Gaza using Israeli SIM cards. Some people thought this is evidence something's coming up, but it was dismissed as just another drill. Now, the head of the intelligence directorate was on vacation at the time, but he since said that even if he'd been around, nothing would have changed, because the political analysis that framed the intelligence was what made the mistake inevitable.
So what's next? Is this the first of many to fall, a few to fall?
We'll have to see what happens in the next few days. If we see continued public outcry, press outcry from his colleagues in the government calling for the prime minister to resign, or for there to be further resignations higher up the military chain of command, then it may not stop here.
Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History, Trinity College, Monk School, and University of Toronto. Jack, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
This is every parent's worst nightmare, and I'm sure you may have heard this story already. A 15-year-old boy is in life-threatening condition after he and two youths attempted to ride the top of a GO train while it was in motion on Saturday night. Three of the teens went outside, climbed under the roof while the train was in motion. One came in contact with a stationary object and fell. The other teens went back inside the moving train, called 911. How does this happen? What needs to be done? Is this all the fault of social media? Let's bring in Brian J. Patterson, president of the Ontario Safety League, in here now. Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Oh, all's well. All's well. Yeah, no, I have to tell you, this was one of the ones, one of the major TV stations ran a piece on these urban challenging players and their media accounts. And I thought, somebody's going to do it in the next 14 days. And it didn't take 14 days. It happened 5 days later.
Yeah.
And I think people watch that. They see it. They think it's something they want to do. And unfortunately, it is, you know, they often say that a young person's brain isn't fully able to assess risk until about 25.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, but I can't believe that you wouldn't know that it was, call it scary, risky, or whatever. But boy, I tell you, if you see it, you better get on your 911. Those calls, instead of trying to take pictures of it, get 911 involved. They're completely connected to the GO safety security side. Same with the with the TTC on this end. They are there to stop that from being a tragedy, but sometimes it is a tragedy.
You know, you have to wonder, and you know, maybe this is the parental side coming out of me, maybe this is the cynical side, but, you know, what if we took a video of this poor boy lying in his hospital bed with his parents around him, hoping that he survives and has some sort of a normal life, and then post that on social media? You know, and this may sound coarse and callous, but maybe we should be posting the other side of this thrill-seeking video and what happens when someone makes a bad choice.
Well, you know, I have the opportunity to spend a lot of time with emergency room staff in some of the critical collisions and issues. And, you know, I have to believe you're spot on there, that if you had to spend 4 hours in an emergency room while they're resuscitating the individual three times and they're having discussions whether a limb has got to be removed, you might think it won't affect everybody, but you'd like to think it would affect enough that we'll start turning the curve in the other direction.
We're putting charred lungs on the side of cigarette packages. Is this any different, Brian?
I don't think it is. In the same way, when we talk about collisions, you know, I think, you know, I worked on Heavy Rescue 401 for 8 years, and people started to realize from watching it, one of the surveys, that they started to understand that, why are all these collisions happening when it's risky? Is because it just takes one person out of the 10,000 trying to get home to race up the shoulder, cut somebody off, yeah, flip a vehicle over. And, you know, riding on the top of a train, I don't know where you would, how you would see that as being safe. And so three kids tells me somebody goaded somebody and off they went. So,
yeah,
the photographer and the two stooges, and there you go. Parents shattered. A young person like that, very likely, it's life-changing in the sense that,
yeah,
you may be impacted physically for the rest of your life.
What about, what can they do to make this, can they lock those doors? Can they have video on the roofs of the train? So if, you know, the engineer sees, oh, someone's on the top, stop the train. I mean, what do you do? Can you, Can you stop this from happening?
Transit organizations have a huge group, and they look at those issues all the time. I mean, one of the reasons you don't want the doors all locked is because in the event of an emergency, you have to move people from a train with a problem to a train without a problem. I don't know if the cost of the cameras would have an immediate impact. But I think talking about it and making sure that anybody's driving home tonight and listening to this station is going to have a chat with their kids and make sure that it's abundantly clear that taking risks has an impact on more than just you. I mean, often people say, well, if that idiot wants to rappel off the CN Tower, that's his risk. But these ones have an impact on many, many people.
Brian J. Patterson with us, president of the Ontario Safety League, commenting 15-year-old boy in life-threatening condition after trying to ride the roof of a GO train. Brian, thanks for the time and insight. Be well.
Thanks again.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You know, there was a time when you'd say two-tier healthcare and you'd be run out of town in this country or out of the country in this country. A new Ipsos report shows that two-tier healthcare is not, and really, what is that? Well, that's what we have, is not the threat it once was. Among respondents, 52% wanted increased access to healthcare provided by independent health entrepreneurs against just the 29% who didn't. And perhaps the most shocking of all is almost everyone agreed, 7 in 10, that private entrepreneurs can deliver healthcare faster than hospitals managed by the government, against the mere 15% who disagreed with that statement. To talk more about all of this, Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos Polling, and with us now. Daryl, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. How are you?
So far, so good. Are you surprised at this, Daryl? When did you start to notice the change here? Because this has been a staple for Canadians for an awfully long time. When did this start to change?
It started to change, I think, through the pandemic.
Yeah.
And has really started to pick up with some momentum. When I first started back in this business, if you can believe it, in the 80s, this was one of those questions that was almost not worth asking.
Yeah.
Because the answer was always the same. The answer was no. In fact, we would regularly see that one of the things that would stand out when we asked about what makes Canada great was that people would cite our healthcare system, particularly comparing it to places like the United States. No longer the case. People are very concerned about our healthcare system and whether or not it will be able to provide them with the services that they feel that they will need when they need them.
It's like we all thought it was better until we realized it wasn't, which, as you pointed out, we saw the weak links during the global pandemic and such. Vaccination and the inability to get those in, did that factor into this in any way? Although it's not certainly, it's apples to oranges, but was all that a factor?
Yeah, I think everything that we went through in the pandemic had an effect, but beyond just the healthcare system, there's just this general sense right now in Canada that our institutions aren't delivering at the level that are up to the level of our expectations. Whether it's the length of time it takes to get a passport, managing the immigration system, what people think about the legal system these days, you could go down the list of areas where Canadians are not particularly happy with the level of service they're receiving from governments. It's a pretty long list, and healthcare, I think, is being slotted into that. It is interesting when you ask people about their personal experiences with the healthcare system, they tend to not be that bad. It's the expectation about what's going to be happening in the future that really tends to grind us down.
I've heard many say, and I could probably address this anecdotally, that once you get in, it's pretty good. It's just trying to get there. It's getting through the door.
Right. And it comes down to timely access.
Yeah.
And there's a feeling right now that we're not getting timely access. And as a result, people are, particularly with the aging population that we have, are getting concerned about what's going to be available. I mean, things, for example, like what was happening in the long-term care situation during the pandemic, certainly was a shocking development. So, you know, the level of certainty that we used to have back in the 80s, that we were doing everything perfectly, that it should always be a single payer system, that we really shouldn't be looking at any alternatives to our system, is not the rock solid set of opinions that used to exist.
And we saw examples of this right the way across the country. It wasn't like it was just happening in Ontario or Quebec or the populous provinces. I mean, this was a common problem right the way across.
Yeah, and what's also changed is that people's contact with the healthcare system, even though they still say that it was reasonably good, it's not going to be like it was before, where they thought it was great.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of just generally what they feel about services delivered by government, plus their own personal experiences with the healthcare system, but most importantly, a serious concern about what's going to be available for them when they need it in the future.
Three quarters of Canadians believe their provincial healthcare system is too bureaucratic. Explain that.
Yeah, they think that there's too much paperwork, too many rules, too many conditions, yeah. And that as a result, things just take too long. Now, part of that might be wishful thinking, in that they think if they could just reduce the bureaucracy, there would be more funds and services or more funds available to pay for the primary services that people feel that they need. Whether that's true or not, we'll leave that up to the experts. But there is just this feeling that there's too much government. And by the way, when you take a look at the single biggest area of employment increase in Canada over the space of the last decade, it has been in the public sector. So they're not far off.
When PharmaCare was announced and dental care, I think a lot of the Liberals and NDP thought this would be a big gain in the polls. Turned out not to be that. And then we're finding out from the associations, whether it's dental or PharmaCare, although they want to get as many people through their doors as they possibly can to help, this isn't necessarily the most efficient way of doing things.
No, and that's where I think that there's at some point there's going to be somebody brave enough in our political system to just like back in the early 1960s when we went through the same thing with Diefenbaker and Pearson when they came up with the rigging for the current system that we have, and because that's how far it goes back. But there's going to be somebody in government sometime in the future. It's going to start asking some more fundamental questions about this, because the desire for change is starting to build.
And if that's being displayed in polling, how long before that actually makes it to policy rooms? Because that obviously is a huge factor in which way governments go.
Yeah, well, the only way that I think it makes it into, becomes a primary approach for governments, and that's where they really start looking at changing the single payer system, is if somebody really, really has a strong mandate, and it's specifically for doing this, because to just spring it on the public wouldn't go over particularly well either.
So where do you see this going? How do you think this will change policy moving forward?
Well, I think that what you're going to see in the healthcare system is a little bit, maybe an acceleration of what's been going on, where instead of trying to change the system overall, all at one time, and go fundamentally to the question of how the whole system is funded, where you're going to start seeing little things start to change. Like, for example, pharmacists now able to give you certain types of medical services that they were never able to give you before. You're going to start seeing nurse practitioners doing more things, nurses doing more. You're going to start to see alternative ways of accessing public services. Like, for example, like you do for some diagnostics, that list will start to expand. So I don't think that there's going to be a situation in which any government in the near term is going to sit down or stand up and say, we're going to just change this thing overwhelmingly overnight in a fundamental way. What you're going to see is this continued incremental change, because the status quo is not going to hold.
All right, Daryl Bricker with the CEO of Ipsos. New polling out is showing our changing attitude towards Canada's highly coveted, much sought after healthcare system. Daryl, thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too. Thank you, Scott.
A research institute in China that is affiliated with the ruling Chinese Communist Party foreign influence operations compiled extensive profiles of members of parliament, Canadian parliament, with Chinese ethnicity. Two sources have said. The sources say these Chinese institutes use large-scale data analysts and artificial intelligence to create detailed profiles in 2022. There are fewer than 10 MPs of Chinese descent in Canada's House of Commons. The profiles drawn up by a research institute that supports work of China's United Front Work Department, which oversees influence from Beijing, propaganda, intelligence, operations inside and outside of China. So to talk more about all of this, Stephen Chase, senior parliamentary reporter with the Globe and Mail, and is here now. Stephen, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm glad to be here.
Stephen, why would they be collecting this data if it's not to interfere or harass the Chinese diaspora? Why would you do this?
The data is being collected in order to figure out ways to gain leverage over people and to pressure them. So it's not simply for academic purposes. This is a report that was prepared in 2022. It was a pilot project in China, and it used, as you said, like data mining and artificial intelligence to really scrape as much information as it could about MPs of Chinese descent in Canada. And of course, as we have reported many times, Chinese Canadians are often the main targets and victims of foreign interference by the Chinese government in Canada.
How significant is this, Stephen? Because it seems this is what you and others have been trying to prove for a very long time.
Yes, what it does is it demonstrates the lengths to which China is willing to go to in order to figure out ways to put pressure on politicians in Canada. And again, the people who are the targets of this are in fact the victims of this. The Chinese government wants to change our thinking on a lot of subjects. They want us to support their crackdown on Muslims in Xinjiang, the concentration camps they've built. They want us to support the squashing of democracy in Hong Kong. They want to support the menacing of Taiwan, their effort to annex Taiwan. So they're hoping to change Canadian mindset to support these things because they need to fight back and push back against the overwhelming opposition to this behavior in the Western world.
The inquiry obviously progressing. Last week we heard of three people speaking for the Chinese Communist Party, but certainly looking for the Canadian government in this inquiry to plainly say that there was no interference and it did not affect the outcome of the election. One of those people defending these actions was the deputy mayor of Markham. How concerned are you that this is coming from people in pretty high positions? Is this too deep to correct?
Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I guess the question is, I think it's clear, and not even the opposition conservatives have said that interference changed the outcome of the election. So I don't think anyone in this country believes it changed the outcome of the election. But there was a significant and malign foreign interference at work. So again, it's a bit of a straw man to say you need to say these are free and fair elections. But everybody knows that the elections, there's nobody in this country who reasonably thinks that the election would have produced a different result had there not been foreign interference. The real problem is that the Chinese government and other governments, but particularly the Chinese government, is getting better and better at foreign interference. And so it's still something that needs to be dealt with, even if it didn't change the outcome of the election. The conservatives, of course, have made their concerns known that about 6 to 9 ridings, there was an unusual drop in conservative support, whereas generally conservative support went up in most ridings in Canada last election.
You talked about various opinions, but when these opinions are expressed, does that raise a red flag, especially when the evidence so clearly says the opposite?
I guess I'm more interested in what the foreign inquiry has to say than what a municipal politician has to say about this, given one has far more access to classified information and a better picture of what happened than the other doesn't.
Are you finding out or understanding or uncovering more information in this inquiry than you thought we would when it was called way back when?
Yeah, I think actually it's been a great exercise. The public media have gotten far greater access to internal classified documents about the foreign interference that went on. We know that there was numerous warnings and documentation of the kind of meddling that was going on. We've actually seen summaries of CSIS evidence, which none of that came out in 2023 when the government hired former Governor General David Johnson to do a quick 2-month turnaround on the file. So we're getting a lot more than what the government wanted to give us at first. And it does show the benefit of having a public inquiry.
Also revealing that perhaps government and CSIS aren't on the same page, don't really even have much of a relationship or not a positive one. Do you see that changing moving forward, a different relationship between our intelligence officials and our governments?
I think one of the problems with intelligence in the federal government is it's not given the pride of place. It's not given a seat at the table. It tends to be kept in the back rooms and only called in to sort of offer advice when the government wants to. I think there should be more regular reporting, more regular briefings, and more CSIS and should be given a more broad hand to warn people more publicly about things. I think one of the problems that's come up is that CSIS has often been ignored or hasn't been able to, didn't have the sort of, that didn't have a commanding height from which to speak to. So it would give its briefing to one person or two people, and they might have forgotten or not acted on it. So there is a sense of that we should be paying more attention to CSIS, and we should be giving it more of a role. And the National Security and Intelligence Advisor's Office should be bulked up. So I think it's going to take changes before there's a better relationship between the government and CSIS. This government seems to be, I think, I would say, uncomfortable with CSIS.
Stephen Chase with us, senior parliamentary reporter with the Globe and Mail. Stephen, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
I've often talked on this show, and you know, I was saying this quite a while ago, and they're not the same, but they are. And that is, there is a huge similarity between Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau. They are the same type of leader, just on opposite ends of the spectrum. And for example, questioning our institutions, trying to discredit our institutions just to cover up their own missteps. And you could say that with Justin Trudeau and his relationship with CSIS. It goes on and on and on. And Brian Lilly writes in the Toronto Sun, Trudeau's budget, nothing more than Trump-style populist campaign. Trudeau is engaging in a populist campaign of class and generational warfare to try to win back voters. I'm going to read you the first paragraph here. Justin Trudeau has apparently decided that engaging in an angry populist campaign against those with money is a way back to power. Those who have paid close attention to Canadian politics have long said there are many similarities between Trudeau and Donald Trump. This is just the latest. Like Trump, Trudeau is trying to harness angst over the cost of living and economic uncertainty by telling Canadians that the problem lies with a specific group of people, and in this case, the wealthy. To talk more about all of this, columnist for the Toronto Sun, Brian Lilly, is here now. Brian, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on. Great to be back on Hometown Radio.
Brian, you know, there used to be a time when populism was only used to describe the right. How come it's now used to describe the left?
Well, if you go back decades, it's been used by both, at various times. The NDP was a populist movement at one point. You go out to Western Canada, they've had provincial parties of the left and the right who have both been populist. And there used to be a federal party called the Social Credit in Pierre Trudeau's minority government days. They held the balance of power. Now, not a lot of us remember those days. I definitely don't. I'm well on now. But, populism is not just a left wing or a right wing thing. It's a view. And Trudeau is feeling the sting of voters turning away from him, in particular, younger voters. He's still doing all right, not great, with older women, but there's not a single demographic group that he leads in. And in 2015, it was younger voters who really put him over the edge, millennials, Generation Z, or Z, however you want to pronounce it. And these are the people frozen out of the housing market who are now angry, who are feeling like, well, the system didn't work for me. I went to school. I got a good job. I got a trade. I got a profession. I'm trying to start a family and I can barely afford rent, never mind getting married, having kids, and buying that first home. So, you know, Pierre Poilievre and the conservatives have said, well, we've got solutions. And he's been putting them out there for the last year. About half of them, the liberals have stolen over the last little while.
Yeah.
But it's not moving the polls. So what's Trudeau decide to do? He decides, I'm going to tell everyone that the reason that they're not doing well is that rich people have all the money and we need to take it from them. And that's what he's doing with his capital gains tax and trying to make it sound like it's just the monopoly man with the monocle and top hat. He's just going after the uber wealthy. But reality is, there are so many people that I grew up with in Hamilton who are tradespeople, who are professionals of one type or another, who own a small business. They're going to get hit by this as well, along with, you know, small-time landlords who own one rental unit, be it an apartment block or a home or something. They're all going to get hit by this. But Trudeau wants you to believe it's just the uber wealthy is going after to solve your problems because they've got the money and you don't.
Many years ago, people would say, or months ago, this is just nothing more. And a lot of them conspiracy theorists. This is just a redistribution of wealth. You know what he's doing? It's just a redistribution of wealth. And now we have financial experts saying the exact same thing. Redistribution of wealth is not the creation of wealth. This has now gotten into the mainstream. People are starting to see this. Is that accurate?
I would say so. I was reminded of one of my favorite political quotes from Winston Churchill when I read the budget last week. A nation trying to tax its way into prosperity is like a man trying to stand in a bucket and pull himself up by the handle. It doesn't work. But that's what Trudeau wants to do. There's a political reason for this. He's hoping that if he can talk about this capital gains tax, and get people convinced that, well, it's not going to hurt you. It's not going to hurt your family doctor who may pack up and retire or pack up and move to North Carolina. It's just going to hurt the uber wealthy and you're going to benefit. Then he can benefit politically. He can get people moving back towards him. If he can get the conservatives talking about this instead of the carbon tax, then he can say, well, they're for the wealthy. They're not for you. They're not for fairness. The conservatives, by the way, are not talking about the capital gains tax at all. They want to keep talking about the carbon tax. This whole ploy, this bizarre change to our tax structure, which will hurt us economically, which will, you know, listen to the guys who started Shopify from nothing to an international behemoth. They're saying this is going to hurt us in terms of getting tech companies funding. The Ontario Medical Association says it will hurt in terms of trying to attract and retain doctors. Accountants are saying it will hurt every small business. And Trudeau has made this change not to make it better for the economy, but for political reasons, so that people will stop talking about the carbon tax, which everyone hates, and talk about this one. And then he can try and use jealousy and envy to win back votes.
Very, very divisive. And, you know, many have said that very, very much from the beginning. And you mentioned in your column how many times he mentioned the word wealthy. I've been saying for months, years, how many times he mentions the middle class. And now it seems now that the middle class has been devastated, it seems now the middle class, that term has been replaced by the wealthy. That's the new target. That's the new buzzword.
Well, do you remember you used to have a minister for the middle class?
Yes, yes.
He got rid of the middle class and the minister for the middle class.
The middle
class are the people who are scrounging, working to get by, and then buying that rental property, a rental property or a property to flip. People like my brother-in-law who, you know, just trying to make a few extra bucks moving towards retirement. And he wants to take, you know, whatever you've got. If you know anybody that's self-employed, I've got a lot of friends who are self-employed, and a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them, they don't have a pension. So what do? They save up their retirement funds inside their corporation.
Yeah.
And that's how accountants have, you know, long told them to do this. And now Trudeau's coming after that retirement fund. We've got people who are just average middle class folks who have worked hard at their self-employment, at building their business, and now they are just going to be devastated by this change.
Brian Lilly with us from the Toronto Sun. Trudeau's budget, nothing more than Trump-style populist campaign. Trudeau is engaging in a populist campaign of class and generational warfare to win back voters. Brian, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott.
Patrick Brown, who is the mayor of Brampton, has penned an article for the National Post. Liberals are not doing enough to combat auto theft. We need to secure our ports, safeguard our streets, and send a clear message to organized crime. To talk more about all of this, Patrick Brown, mayor of Brampton, in here now. Patrick, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for having me on the show today.
So, Patrick, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate this. But we heard that there was a whole pile of money being spent on auto theft and that there was a big summit there in Ottawa. Is this not doing enough, Patrick?
Yeah, so it's been frustrating for me because I've been on this file for 3 years, ever since I've seen, you know, auto theft start to skyrocket in the GTA. You know, I remember 2 years ago meeting with the public safety minister at the time, the previous one, and he said, we're just focused on guns. And I'm sitting there with our deputy chief of police and him, and we said, what do you think they're using the stolen cars for? To purchase guns. So, you know, we've been leading this push to get scanners in the ports. As you know, local police officers are not allowed on rail lines or ports because they're federal jurisdiction. And so the local police can follow the, you know, the tracker. They can follow someone's, you know, AirPod, and it goes to the shipping container or the rail line, and we're not allowed, the police are not allowed on. And so we've been pushing for jurisdiction, but also scanners. And why this is so important is, you know, 80% of auto thefts are sent to the Port of Montreal and Ontario and Quebec, and they're for the international market. It is very lucrative. In 2022, it was $1.2 billion in auto thefts. The 2023 numbers could be in the range of $2 billion. This is the biggest gift in Canadian history to organized crime, and it's funding some of the most heinous criminal activity in our country. In the United States, they scan 45% of their shipping containers. So organized crime knows in the U.S. they're going to get caught. A 1 out of 2 chance they're going to get caught. In Canada, we scan less than 1%. We use something called an honor system. You just need to sign a piece of paper saying there's no stolen goods in your shipping container. It is broken. It doesn't work. It needs to be fixed. We need those scanners in yesterday. The government of Canada announced in February at the Auto Theft Summit they were going to fund scanners. Nothing has happened. The Port of Montreal doesn't want them. But the Port of Montreal needs to take direction from the government of Canada. The Minister of Public Safety needs to say, they're coming. We're insisting on it.
It just seems insane that the U.S. is scanning 45% of containers and we barely do one. And we've had this discussion with when it comes to gun crime. You know, the Liberals will talk about banning handguns or this. It's like, check the border, check the border. And I'm guessing if you're looking at the border, whether it's this one or an international port with Montreal, what have you, that if you're looking for guns, you're going to find cars too.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, organized crime is not interested in collecting cars. They're stealing cars for money, and the money is supporting guns, it's supporting drugs, in some cases even terrorism. You know, we had a presentation from the RCMP on this and international law enforcement agencies, and this is funding the most heinous crimes. It is not about cars, it's about dangerous criminal activity.
So what should government be doing, Patrick? Where are we missing the boat? Obviously, scanning containers is a major issue, and I'm sure most Canadians would just shake their heads at that. But what are some of the basic things we should be doing?
So the good news is there is a solution. Every chief of police will tell you this is solvable. We don't need to scan every shipping container because we know some of the shipping routes are very safe. But we know where the stolen cars are going. There's certain markets in the world that is very popular for stolen cars, for the resale of stolen cars. And so we can scan those shipping containers. Each shipping container, each scanner costs about $3.5 million. I'm told we need about 4 shipping containers at the Port of Montreal, 1 at each of the intermodal hubs. There's an intermodal hub with CN in Brampton, and there's an intermodal hub with CP in Vaughan. and that's like a rail line directly to the port. We put those scanners in those three locations, we're going to shut down the industry in central Canada. It will be devastating for organized crime if we do that. But we also have to staff them, and we have to give law enforcement jurisdiction. And this is something that's very important, because we had a project recently that was announced called Project Vector. It was a joint collaboration of the Peel Police, Toronto Police, the RCMP, Montreal Police, and CBSA. And they gave our local law enforcement access to the Port of Montreal. Now, very briefly, it was only for a day. But in that day that our local police were given access to the Port of Montreal, they managed to inspect 398 shipping containers, and they found 600 stolen cars in those shipping containers. Now, 398 shipping containers sounds like a lot, but they have 2 million a year that goes through the Port of Montreal. So, you know, just imagine if this was a regular thing, if police could regularly, you know, have scanners that inspect shipping containers. It would change the game in Canada. Right now, auto theft is 10 times the rate in Canada than it is in the U.S., and they're the same cars. They're the same security devices. The only difference is we don't scan our shipping containers.
You know, many have said, because for the longest time, Patrick, nobody seemed to care about this. As long as the insurance company, you know, covered your car and all the prices were baked in, and then all of a sudden everybody, including your neighbor next door, was getting their car stolen if you weren't, and it's sometimes more than once, and they're breaking into homes to do this. It just never seems that it's been a priority here, and it's always, you know, technology's fault. It's up to the manufacturers, that sort of thing. It's not necessarily law enforcement or even the penalty for these crimes. Many in law enforcement have called our prime minister the catch and release prime minister. Can we keep blaming tech and the manufacturers? And as you said, it's not happening in the United States, where the cars are the same to the same volume that is here.
Yeah, I don't think it's tech and manufacturing. They're the same cars. You're absolutely right. The difference is sentencing, and the difference is the port. And you know, one of the defenses from the Port of Montreal has been, you know, we don't want to slow down our supply chain. Well, they do it in the U.S. without affecting their supply chain. The other issue is they say, well, the police can get a warrant. The problem is, if the police get a warrant, they come and look at the shipping container and it's already gone. The ability to go and scan containers without notice. Unfortunately, and this is, you know, quite tragic, but every time police actually get a warrant issued, the shipping container gets moved or it's gone. And so it's broken. We need accountability, transparency at the Port of Montreal. This is a major problem that is enriching criminal organizations across Ontario and Quebec.
And you also, it raises suspicion, who's in on this? Who, like, why is this so difficult to crack when it's not as hard in the United States? Do you think we're making gains here, Patrick? Do you think you're going to see changes?
Well, we're trying to mount pressure on Ottawa to do this. In February, they announced the funding for it, but there's been no movement. And I'm told it's because of pushback at the Port of Montreal. I think the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister need to have the courage to say to the Port of Montreal, to say to CBSA, we're not accepting rationalization for this anymore. You have to accept this. And frankly, anyone pushing back against having scanning capacity at the Port of Montreal, I have to ask why.
Exactly.
Because are they part of it?
Good question. Patrick Brown, Mayor of Brampton, has a column in the National Post. Liberals are not doing enough to combat auto theft. We need to secure our ports, safeguard our streets, and send a clear message to organized crime. Patrick, thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Good luck.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you are doing well.
Scott, if I was any better,
there'd be two Scotts.
There would be two. Well, there are, but yes.
Never mind. Yeah,
yeah. How are you?
I'm enjoying Earth Day. Happy Earth Day to you.
Yes, thank you. I went out and used my gas lawnmower to cut my grass on Earth Day, and things are good.
Well,
drove into
you.
Work. Use some electricity.
I was going to add to that, but I think you pretty much covered it. Let me ask you this question. Don't you think every day is Earth Day in Canada? Because every day we're talking about carbon. Every day we pay a carbon tax. Every day it affects our lives. It's got to the point where it's even affected an election when it comes. Isn't every day Earth Day in Canada with our 1.5% of greenhouse gases? I'm not trying to be cynical, okay? But I think it's time to take every Earth Day and not just go out and pick up some trash, but also to analyze whether, go back over the last 20, 30 years, are we doing anything? Are we making a dent? And I'll refer to this. I remember asking Elizabeth May of the Green Party just within the year, why don't we, instead of like going all over the place with these piecemeal programs and trying to shut the taps off and condemn anybody that doesn't want to do that, why don't we just try to get the world off of coal, since it is such a big world polluter, and then go from there? And she, without even batting an eye, too late for that. And, you know, I remembered she said that to me 20 years earlier, and thinking, you know, well, if we'd done it 20 years ago, maybe we'd be farther ahead. Is the environment movement really helping? Is it just creating division?
Well, it's Scott.
I think they failed us.
I think that there is, look, I think we all want to have a clean environment. I don't think anyone is suggesting otherwise. But the flip side is, I also think that we should be reasonably able to expect in 2024 that we are not going to take ourselves back to the Stone Ages, which is which seems to be what some of those on the extreme end would want. We're not going to have any cars. We're only going to use bikes and, you know, public transit and electric cars.
Electricity, all the eggs in one basket.
Heat pumps and no gas. And you know, as you start going down this path, the problem with the argument is that many of the people, I don't think, have thought this through to the full amount that they should. Because, you know, many of the, for example, many people who would argue such things would be on social media, would be firing off social media tweets on their iPhone, which is made in part from fossil fuels and plastic. And you go down the list of these things, we would have to essentially undo almost all of the things that we use in our life. I'm sitting here in the studio right now, and I don't think this studio is unusually weirdly anti-Earth. And I can look around and I can see 20 things just as I'm glancing around here that if we were going to try and get rid of fossil fuels, we would have to get rid of these things too, because they have fossil fuel as part of the making of them, either in the product or delivering them or whatever else. And somehow we seem to have taken these two positions. One is the extreme. And to answer your question, those on the extreme, I don't believe that they are helping their cause at all, because I don't think it's thought through. I think the people who are moderate and who look at this and say, look, I want to have a clean earth. I want to maybe cut back on our pollution. I want to pick stuff up. I want to maybe cut back on emissions. But I also understand we are living a life in the modern age when this is simply part of our reality. It is. And unless, you know, it's always surprised me, Scott, that those people who are the most yelling and screaming for getting rid of all this stuff, they aren't living in huts in the woods, burning wood, because again, that's bad too. You know, they are living essentially, for all intents and purposes, with some differences, the same life as the rest of us, but saying that this same life is a horrible, horrible thing. I don't know. I find those who are on the furthest extreme, what's her name from Sweden?
Greta.
The whole thing is ludicrous. If we were truly to live the style of life that she and those who follow along with her would suggest, we would be back to the Stone Age. And I don't think there is a single person, including them, who, if you really were to push them, would want that.
You know, I remember very vividly when the Prime Minister and the Premier came to town and DeFasco was going electric, and I had them all on the air and said, well, except for the Prime Minister, he doesn't come on, and said, like, how are they going to flip the switch and not put Hamilton into darkness when all this happens? And of course, how they're going to do this is by a 20-year transition with natural gas. And nobody from any of the environmental places had any clue this was going on. And then all of a sudden there was a permit to allow Enbridge to put a gas line down Centennial Parkway to help DeFasco do this transition. There was natural gas. What are you doing? What are you building a pipeline for? So the environmentalists are totally zoomed in on what their issue is, but they have absolutely no idea how they're going to get there or what the alternative is. And the fact that all of these people had no idea that natural gas was going to be used by DeFasco with the transition between coal and electricity just shows you how they are not plugged into reality. They're very good at knowing their own little, their own little sheet of paper. But as far as how we get there, no idea. And that to me was a great example.
Scott, in a way, it would be like someone saying, okay, so you know what? You and I don't know about you. I haven't seen you in a little while in person. But, okay, I could probably use a diet to lose 10 pounds. But there is a difference when you say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to cut back on the chips that I eat when I watch TV at night. And me saying, you know what? I think we should ban all chips because they are bad for human beings and they make everybody, there is a difference. And I think most people are in agreement with the idea that, you know what? I need to do some things to make myself a little bit better. Where they blanch is when you have extremists saying, because I believe this, you must do the same or you are a horrible person who only wants bad things. That, I think people, honestly, there is more and more pushback to that. I think people have reached the end of their tether with that kind of stuff. And, it's not just this. We can talk about this we're seeing down at this in university right now, in Columbia University, we're seeing this with extremism taking root, whether it's politics, whether it's Gaza, the planet, whatever. And I believe people are about at the point where they're going to start saying, you know what, you do you, leave me alone.
I think the pendulum is swinging back. Agree. All right. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in The Spectator. As always, Scott, thanks for the time. Have a good one.
Thanks. And I didn't suggest that you need to lose any pounds, Scott. You look terrific.
No,
I'm sure.
No. And I just did see you the day of the eclipse, in case you forgot. But I guess that it was dark that day. All right, Scott, have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from John via email on air pollution. Scott, when forest fire season arrives, I wonder if our carbon savings efforts will be worth it. Keep right, except to pass.